Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Andy Griffiths, author, treehouse connoisseur, fearless guide through a maze of nonsense. Welcome to All the Wonders, the children's book podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 254 of the podcast with Andy Griffiths, author of the 52-story Treehouse, the fourth installment in the 13-story Treehouse series with illustrator Terry Denton. These liberally illustrated novels feature two boys named Andy and Terry, who live in an ever-expanding dream treehouse and who perpetually find themselves under deadline to submit their newest book manuscripts to their publisher, Mr. Big Nose. Parents looking for what book to hand their child after finishing the newest Wimpy Kid need look no further. These stories are hilarious, they're ridiculous, and they're just so much fun. Listen on to discover the meaning of my newest favorite portmanteau, Revengetarian. Here's episode number 254 of the podcast with Andy Griffiths. Welcome to the podcast, Andy Griffiths. I'm so excited to get to talk to you tonight.
Thank you. I'm very happy to talk to you, too.
Andy, I love your books. I love the ridiculousness of them. I love the way that it seems, more than almost anyone I know, that you get kids and you get their humor and you just, the stories that you share and the work that you do with Terry is just so fun and so random. I love it. I love it so much.
Well, it's random, but it's kind of logically random.
It is.
Somehow.
There's sort of this really great, like, whenever something pays off in the story, you sort of have that moment of like, well, I should have seen that coming. It's not that random, but it's wonderful. You also, well, by the way, you contributed, like, my new favorite portmanteau in 52-story Treehouse. The Revengetarian is my favorite word now.
I hope you've been practicing it, eating those vegetables so we get revenge on them.
It's the greatest.
Look, I did feel a bit guilty about the diet of Andy and Terry in the treehouse, because as the series has built up, we find that they eat marshmallows that are fired at them by a marshmallow machine that automatically senses they're hungry. They swim in a chocolate fountain. They drink from a lemonade fountain. They have an ice cream parlor with 78 different flavors of ice cream. And I was feeling a bit guilty by the time we got to 52-story Treehouse, the fourth book, that, God, all these kids do, all these boy men, whatever they are, eat is sugar, and it's not good. And I don't actually do that in real life. And my wife, Jill, who is a co-author and editor of the series along with me and Terry, she said, just relax. It's just fantasy. The normal rules don't apply in that. And I understood that, but I really wanted to make a plot that would have the very positive message that kids had to eat their vegetables and yet still be funny and still keep them outside. So that was the ultimate challenge of this book.
I think it's terrific, and I think that it's pulled off really well. And it makes me feel every time we add 13 more stories to this treehouse, it just the different rooms that you end up sort of whirlwinding us through in the beginning of each story just feels a little bit like, here are a bunch of really awesome ideas that I've received either from my own brain or from school visits, and let's just talk about. I mean, it feels like I work with children every day. It feels, Andy, and I'm saying this as in the highest compliment I can offer. It feels like you sit down with children. The book feels like a reflection of sitting with children and just going like, okay, let's imagine a 13-story treehouse. What's in it? And you just hear firing off all of their favorite, most amazing ideas ever. And sure, it's in there. Okay, great. Let's add that too. Yeah, it's just very off the cuff and
Well,
playful.
yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it comes from 20 years of being an author in schools and working with kids, telling them stories, watching what makes them laugh. And before I was an author, even as a child, I enjoyed entertaining other children by usually winding them up and just telling them the most ridiculous thing I could. And they would argue, that's not true. And then I would go, yes, it is true, because, and then I'd invent some supporting detail that proved that the nonsense I was saying was true. And I've never tired of that game. And kids, I love leading kids into just a maze of nonsense. And then they're questioning, they're arguing, but I think at the same time they're growing creatively, and that's my interest. So yeah, with the levels come from a process of list making. I'll sit down with the numbers 1 to 13 and try to come up with the most entertaining, varied levels I can. That process takes probably 6 to 12 months to finalize. And sometimes kids, I'll run it by kids, and sometimes they'll throw in something so random that I just have to include it. In the 52, it was the ninja snail training academy.
So good. And again, another example of something that pays out. It pays out in the end, and it's so good.
Well, that's the other thing I do, is I start with all these levels. Well, I know the levels, and then I paint myself into a corner as the plot goes on. So I just things get more and more impossible, and they get the book done, but now there's only 2 minutes to midnight, and they can't possibly deliver it in time. And then I have to really, I mean, it's torture sometimes, very sweet torture, but I have to figure out how am I going to get them there, and I was talking to Jill one day, and I said, "Well, they could stop time by firing the enchanted carrot into the heart of the Greenwich Time Observatory, and then the snails would be able to make their 100-year journey." So it all kind of makes sense at that point.
Well, I the it's that it's what you're modeling the children to, the idea of we can be as zany as possible, but when you tie in any sort of logic at all, even if it's just within the rules of the story you're creating, within the world that Terry and Andy live in, as long as you can explain the rules within there, well, that's how great fantasy works. As long as the world they live in is abiding by the rules that are set out for that world, then it can be whatever you want within that context.
Yeah, and there's some beautiful moments that, well, I say beautiful about my own work, but it's really Terry's work and Jill's work as well. And we sometimes just achieve these transcendent little moments of stupidity. For instance, they go on a long, long journey through and fight all these dangerous, ridiculous things. And then when it comes time to go home, Terry says, well, Andy's been riding Terry, who's dressed as a horse.
Yes.
And Terry says, is it your turn to be the horse now? And Andy goes, no, I think we'll just take the tram.
Take the tram home.
He says, what, it's a tram? Well, why did you ride me all the way here? And he says, well, horses aren't allowed on trams. it makes perfect sense. But at the same time, I'm breaking the rules of the story because, you know, you can't just invent a tram at the last moment like that. But in this book, you can. So...
Yeah, well, there's sort of, I mean, that's the consistency of the whole series, too, is just the absurdity of the way that you find a solution, but it's so wonderful. Wasn't it in 39 story that you did, that they get locked out of their, they invent the machine to write the stories for them, but then it turns against them and locks them out of the treehouse, and you have a, is it Professor Stupido or something like that?
That's it.
Yeah.
He has to come and Andy says to Terry, you know,
he undoes things, uninventing. Yes, that's
inventing the machine. You can't uninvent it. And Terry says, oh, there's an uninventor living on the dark side of the moon. We'll go get him and he can uninvent the machine. But whatever solution they come up with becomes the new and ever more serious problem. So, of course, Professor Stupido becomes far more of a problem than the machine that he was brought to fix.
Right.
Which, you know, follows just classic storytelling at that point, and particularly humour. Cat in the Hat, for instance, I think, yeah, every solution he brings in to fix up the mess only creates more and more mess. And as kids, we just love that. As adults, I think we enjoy watching the comedic character without skills, without talent, without a clue of what they're doing, trying confidently to fix the problem. And that's what makes a comic character, I think. They've really got no idea. And I actually came out and said it in this one, you know, when they're in the detective agency and they're trying to find a clue as to why their publisher has disappeared. and Terry says something like, we need clues. And Andy says, you're right. You don't have a clue. I don't have a clue. None of us have a clue. We need a clue. And that, to me, is the essence of those characters. They think they have a clue, but they actually don't. And that's why we kind of love them as they bumble along, creating mayhem.
Yeah, and just sort of relying on one another, but yet blaming one another for the process as you go.
Well, I think there's a great friendship at the heart of this book. And it was funny because Terry and I have been creating books together for well over 15 years. And we've experimented with all types of humour, you know, just rambunctious, kind of slightly rebellious humour. Yeah. We've got extreme graphic violence with a book like Killer Koalas from Outer Space.
Yes.
That goes to the limits. it's not for everyone. But we've also done some gentle humour, just really nice early readers kind of material. I mean, the big fat cow that goes kapow, believe it or not, is actually quite gentle. And then what we did with the treehouse was we kind of blended all that together.
Yeah.
And I think the friendship, as well as the tree, gives you a safe place from which you can take shelter from all the unexpected, slightly disturbing stuff that happens. You've got a cozy treehouse, and at the heart of that, you've got the friendship between Andy, Jill, and Terry. Yeah. So just like any brothers and sisters or friends, you can have your falling outs and your fights and your jibes, but underneath it all, you know they're never actually going to part, and they are looking out for each other when it matters.
You do get that. They never walk away from each other. They always do rely on one another. You're right. And you need one another there to make the story function. And you're absolutely right. I think that's why it works, is that it's just revealing about the way they poke at each other. But then, yeah, the way that you see, oh, they really do deeply need each other, even when they can or can't articulate that.
Well, you know, the essence comes from our real life relationship. Yeah. Yeah. Where I love structure. I'm obsessed with plots that actually are going somewhere and have a kind of forward movement. Terry is obsessed with randomness and just going off the track at any possible point. And you can ask him to do a drawing of, say, a swimming pool, and he'll do the drawing, but he'll have a cow swimming around in it. And you'll say, "Why'd you put the cow in?" And he goes, "Oh, I don't know. I just like drawing cows," which is part of the delight of working with him, because as an author, I then have to make sense of that cow. I have to come up with an explanation of why there's a cow in the swimming pool. And then that generates story. And then I need more drawings of more cows. And suddenly the book is happening in a very organic way. But it's really because Terry is always going somewhere unexpected. And then we make sense of that.
So when you, what does your writing process then look like? When does Terry come in to start? Do you start, is it like that you're writing sort of an idea of what the first, I don't know, first three chapters or something, what they look like, and then you sort of improvise from there?
Well, in the early days, it used to be me writing the story and Terry illustrating after the story was written. And I knew Terry's stream of consciousness, free association, was not being used to its full extent. So we started meeting every week, and we just had no agenda. We just had our notepads and his sketch pad, and we would just make each other laugh with the most ridiculous idea, or he would draw something really silly and I'd try to match it with some words. And that's really how the partnership began. And we as I said, experimented with many, many different styles of books and ways to do this. But by the time the treehouse came, I think I'd asked him to draw a treehouse with a bowling alley in it, for a completely different purpose. As I said, you know, the world's most dangerous treehouse, bowling alleys, tank full of man-eating sharks. And then he drew this 13-story architectural marvel, and I just went, oh, my goodness, that's the treehouse I've always wanted. You know, if I was 10, that's what I would want. And I said, let's write about ourselves in the treehouse. And I'm trying to get the book done, and you're just messing around, and I have to run after you and fix these things. But then all that messing around becomes the eventual substance of the book. So that was where we started. And usually these days I'll just start saying, right, in 52-story treehouse we have a problem with vegetables. They've kidnapped Mr. Big Nose, and we have to go and find him in the vegetable kingdom. And at some point we're probably going to end up in a pot being boiled to make human soup. And I may have no more ideas than that, but Terry will just sit down and, as I talk, start sketching out various evil vegetables, sketching us in a pot. Yeah. And that gets me very excited. And then I'm telling him to do this, do that. And then that might go for a week, that process. And then Jill and I will take all of those drawings and start cutting and pasting them together to make story sequences that that satisfy us. And then we've got big gaps, but we'll kind of fill in the gaps with what if this happened, and oh, we've got to go to Jill's house, etc.
That's sort of so,
sorry. Then we get Terry back in to give us those more fills. Yeah. So it goes back and forth for a year. That process ultimately takes a year.
That the cutting and pasting and going back and forth like that then feels revealing of why the book is formatted in the way that it is, that you've got some times where you go through an expanse of, I don't know, sometimes 10 or 15 pages where it's just a line on the page and a full page illustration. Or in the case of this story, we've got Vegetable Patty. We see almost an entire picture book within this book itself. But yep. It's that pacing that there are times, I mean, I think about my readers and how sometimes they love these books, one, because they're such big meaty books. You've got like a 300 page count on these books. And yet they can fly through them. But it's neat the way that there are times that the story slows down and you are physically slowing down, turning the pages, and other times when it goes very, very quickly. And I think that one of the neat parts of it, having the illustration there, as prevalent as it is that then it becomes very easy too for the kids to go back and reference their favorite parts and go back and see sort of the clues you laid in the beginning that pay off again in the ending. That's great. I mean, I just think the format, to hear you going back and forth like that, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, it's deliberate that we did it that way because I'm aware that every word for an emerging reader, it costs effort. It's as fully developed readers, we can fly across the page and it's just automatic. But when you're learning, you've got to decode a word, and then you've got to decode a whole sentence, and then a whole paragraph, and that can be hard, slow work. So what I began to realize was that with Terry, I could hold back on those words and just say, "Here's our treehouse. Check out our tank full of man-eating sharks," and that's all I have to say. And then he draws an incredibly vivid, detailed picture, usually with something happening. There's a little story in that thing of Terry about to be eaten by a shark. So the payoff, there's many payoffs, but for me, it's telling a really good, meaty, complex story with as few words as possible, which is actually quite hard to do. And that's partly why we spend a year, because we're just going over and over it, just extracting words and sentences that don't need to be there. And but you've still got a framework of words to read if you're reading out to the class or you're reading to your child in bed. I never want to go fully graphic. I want that kind of hybrid of just enough words, but a really complex story.
Yeah, and the illustrations do, I mean, in the way a good picture book does too, the illustrations carry a lot of the weight, as you're saying. And so it's cool to hear that there's times when Terry is giving you illustrations where you're like, oh, well, here's a detail that I hadn't thought about before, a flying egg ship. How am I going to work this into the story? And to have that back and forth,
Well,
yeah.
in that case, I think I came up with that because I knew that he would be able to do it, but I didn't know how he would be able to do it. And he often amazes me, because I'll describe something like that, and I can't draw, even though my character in the book insists that he's easily as good as Terry. But yeah, I've got no idea how he's going to solve these challenges. But because I know he can, I delight in coming up with ever more silly things. They're little challenges.
You've
Try. Bet you can't do this.
And then he does, and he's like, "Bet you can't write your way out of this, buddy."
Yeah.
What a neat
And,
way to have that relationship go. And you said like
well,
15 years or something, you said, right?
20 years, actually. He was assigned to an early book I did, a book full of, creative writing techniques and classroom exercises, and he was assigned as a freelance illustrator to the project because they knew he had a good sense of humor, and we just clicked. I saw what he drew, and it was exactly what I would have drawn if I could have drawn, and so I think I bring some structure for him, and he brings some randomness, and it's just very, very productive and fruitful.
And how terrific that you get on as well as you do. I mean, that you're able to continue this relationship and create books and create more story. And I know in Australia, are you two books ahead or just one book ahead?
I think at the moment we're two books. No, we're one book ahead. We're up to the 65 story treehouse in Australia, but yeah, 52 is where it starts really getting a lot of fun. I think the characters really come into focus in this book, and yeah, there's a plot. There's at least one subplot and other things going on. I think 65 is operating with two subplots, so
Oh,
we're getting
cool.
fancier and fancier as we go along.
I liked from even from 13, the way that you're looking at the writing process, and now to see characters here that we're starting off with just writing a story. How do we write in the 13 story trios? How do we write a book within this time for Mr. Big Nose? And then we move into more looking at plot, and then moving into, well, what if someone just writes it for us? And now to see the focus so much on character this way, and what happens when there's an absent publisher and you're creating something on your own, or hoping to have, I mean, in this way, literally characters living out the story.
I think if you watch kids playing, they're often narrating the story. Yeah. You know, let's be this, you be that, and I'll be this guy, and then this will happen, and then they're playing it and they're living it, even though they're at one level they're very conscious that they're creating it. And Jill and I used to be working away on the books, and we'd be going, oh, what if Terry said that, and then what if Jill did this? And our daughter was on the floor playing with all her dolls, and she was engaged in exactly the same process. And I would often marvel at that she had a whole vivid story going on in her head, that the dolls were all going out on a picnic, so they all had to get in the car and go up the steps to the next level in the house. And, and if we looked at her, she'd say, stop looking at me. You're making me self-conscious.
Yeah, you're taking her out of that play. Oh, yeah.
I always love it in a book where the characters are aware that they're in a story and they're addressing the reader directly. And I think many of my favorite books and classic books talk to the reader, you know, and that's how these books start. Hi, I'm Andy. And I feel like most of our readers, you're probably wondering, you know, how long it takes to write a book. I think Lewis Carroll does it. Roald Dahl does it. Dr. Seuss certainly does it. I think there's a real power when you're talking to kids to actually address them like you know them, and I think it makes you melt.
I think that the power of saying not only that you wrote this story for them, because as an author that's what you do, you're writing for that audience and writing to entertain and writing stories, but also then in the book, like you're saying, with the character speaking out, the kids are part of the story. They are experiencing it as if they are, you know, an audience walking along with Andy and Terry. And so I'm sure when you do your school visits, you probably get a lot of kids creating their own chapters and stories of their own treehouse stories.
Yes.
It must. I mean, this story, yeah, it begs to be played with that way.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's in the very title of the setting of the treehouse. The treehouse is a place in a tree that's away from the ground, away from adults, and where you can really just create your own world. And that, to me, is a metaphor for what it is when you're with a book. A book is a form of play and a very personal intense form of play between you and the writer who is present in the words of the page. So, I think Treehouse just allowed us to talk about the process. And I meet so many kids who say, I want to be a writer, and how do you do this and how do you do that? So in a way, we're modeling it for them in the book.
And what a great way to model.
Oh.
Telephone. What a great way to model, though.
I'll just get rid of that. Yep.
I was just saying, though, Andy, what a great way to model that you have them engaged in this story, and then also showing the opportunity to write your own and tell the story that way. I want to thank you for coming on and chatting with me tonight, but I also bring with me all the excitement of all of the readers from my own library, and I know from all over our country, and probably I know all over the world, that are so much a part of your stories and are so eager to get the next iteration and the next, because it continues to be part of their own story. So thank you for doing that, Andy.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you. And to see it move out of Australia is something that we never actually thought. Never even occurred to us that would happen.
Oh, I should ask, when, at what point did that happen? How far into the series were you that that Fievel and friends brought it over to here.
I think we're into about probably the second or third book at that point.
It was a long.
We've, as you know, we've been making books for a very appreciative audience in Australia for a long time.
Right.
But when we hit the 13-story treehouse, we suddenly went, oh, God, something's going on here, because suddenly everyone was into it, young kids, parents. It was just, there was an accessibility about it. And each book has subsequently become more and more popular. So, and then that started translating. But we didn't try to tone down our Australianness for the rest of the world, because it's impossible for us. But somehow we avoided the more extreme manifestations of that humour, and got something that everyone can enjoy. And certainly we love creating this one, so I think that comes across as well.
And what a great way to take this path too, to build that great audience and support at home of everyone that loyally loves what you're writing and continues to love what you're writing, and then have something come out, some story emerge in your time in writing and creating that just ends up shaking everyone, rocking everyone, to be able to have that then reach even further. I feel like that's what happens. We talk to kids all the time about how you don't know when that one thing you say or that one thing you do is suddenly going to reach far beyond your grasp.
Yeah. Yeah. You can only be yourself.
Yes.
And that sometimes it's really hard to be as a writer, because when you're being yourself, totally, you're being quite original and you're not like other writers. And that can really throw you. And it certainly threw me in the early years, that I felt like what I was doing was not proper writing, because it didn't look like any other book that I quite knew. So I thought, oh, well, it's all wrong, but it's kind of funny, so I'm just going to keep doing it because there's this perverse part of me that enjoys being different and annoying people, because they can't quite make sense of it. And that to me is a lot of fun.
Keep them guessing. I love it. Well, Andy, I want to close by giving you the last word and by bringing it back to the children. But I, again, thank you so much for all of this. So I'm going to see a library full of children tomorrow, and I'd love to ask you, what message would you like me to bring them from you?
I would like to tell them that the treehouse is a really fun place with a lot of great stuff to do, and there are no rules, but I would suggest they don't go in the maze of doom, because nobody who's ever gone into the maze of doom has ever come out again. Now, I can't stop them from going in the maze of doom, but I strongly suggest they don't.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if the episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook and Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Cale Atkinson returns to the podcast to share Explorers of the Wild, his newest picture book, an And after that, Julia Dinos joins me to share Swatch, The Girl Who Loved Color, her picture book debut as both the book's author and illustrator. See you then, and thanks for listening.
We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.